Greetings and welcome back to Soundbites by Bill Bench. I'm your host, Bill Bench. This is our third season of Battery's Go-to-Market podcast. And this session has been a long time in the making. I'm really excited to have my next guest join me today. It's somebody that I have a good, rich amount of history with, and I'm excited to dive into. And in fact, I suspect that this session might be so deep on content that we may break it into two sessions, or as Phil, I think, really aptly said when we were talking about this, it'll be like the Led Zeppelin classic album, Physical Graffiti. It's like a double album. So with that, let me give you the intro. Casimir,
man.
Yeah, exactly. Side two. So Phil Fernandez, co-founder and CEO of Marketo, someone that I had the pleasure and the experience of working with for almost a decade of my career, is joining us today to talk about trip down memory lane. We will cover some Marketo stories that will be interspersed in with hopefully a lot of learnings, because I think there's a lot of nuggets, a lot of scenarios that came out of that period that apply to the founders that are listening today. And then lastly, we will tackle some modern go-to-market topics of what the world with AI looks like, how that's affecting the go-to-market areas of marketing and sales. So that's our agenda for today. But Phil, I wanted to welcome you aboard to Soundbites.
Great to be here. This is a thrill. It should be a lot of fun, and I am super looking forward to it. Man, it's been almost 20 years we've known each other. It's kind of a little bit scary.
Almost. I guess I've lost a little bit of hair in that time.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures when you were 22 as well.
I know. That is rough. I always try to show that to young professionals and say, like, look, rock it while you got it, because this wasn't exactly in the plans. Let's dive down. As I mentioned, we'll start with going back in time to some things from Marketo, because I think there's some outstanding learnings that come from that. So let's go back to early momentum and some of the concepts that we explored there, like logo-based velocities and how we always kept growing. Phil, your recollection of those early years of go-to-market inside of Marketo, what springs to mind for you?
Well, it was never easy, but it was, you know, it was a fascinating momentum game from the early days. You know, Marketo had a very interesting start. We had our first product in the market just 4 months after we raised money and opened the doors. Probably just about the time I first met you, but before you came to join us. It was a product-led growth product sold on a credit card for an average price of $800 a month. It was, you know, a classic kind of high-velocity business that actually got a lot of initial momentum because it was able to ride the coattails of an external event that was so important. Google was emerging into the world with AdWords and pay-per-click, and it was creating just a dislocation everywhere in the marketplace. And John and Dave and I, my co-founders for Marketo, spotted that and just had an amazing product. So we actually had a lot of mo. But it was also churning just as fast as it was happening. And we were just running in a million miles an hour to stand in place. But we also had just an amazing early birth at Marketo of the main product event, which is that my co-founder, John Miller, just did an incredible job of getting a bunch of CMOs lined up ready to buy our product the day it was available. And literally, there was almost a little fight that broke out among early customers about who got to be the first customer in February of 2007 when we got going. Sorry, that's February 2008. And, you know, that was the start of what was just an amazing sprint that we had going on of a lot of momentum. And it's something that, you know, ultimately you and I got together and just managed to just pour kerosene on the fire and get it going. And it was all about running a monthly cadence, all about figuring out how could we get as many deals done in a month, as many logos. And in fact, our quotas in those early days were, as we call it, were quotas and not dollars. And then figure out at the end of the month, we'd be like, okay, month's done. Now starting tomorrow, what do we got to do? And the basic story was, you know, if we did 16 quotas this month, you know, it's going to be 17 next month or 18. And the idea is if you just every month, you do just a little bit better than last month.
I certainly wasn't there for the PLG credit card days, but the latter part of what you spoke about there of the monthly cycles, I think you and I are both firm believers that if your business sets up for that kind of model to do it, I think it really trains the flywheel effect of an organization to work that way, and there's great benefit to it. And then on the logos, I certainly remember that. One thing that I took away from our early experience of working together that I think is really applicable to founders and their teams today is, like you said, we would finish a month and you and I would sit down in the first day or two of a new month, and I would print off a physical copy of all of the order forms that we had done. And you and I would go through the deals. We would go and inspect them and decide, like, this is a good quality deal. This is a bad quality deal. We don't like this discount. We don't like these terms. And it really helped shape what I think became our rules of engagement. And really importantly, we would also at that moment, like you said, literally reset the quota. Like, what did we do last month? 16 new logos. Okay, well, let's make it 17 this month.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, I don't think we waited to the next day even, Bill. I think I just remember sitting around, it'd be dark out at night and be sitting in there at 8 or 9 o'clock at night and the last dealer would come across the finish line and we'd be already doing our recap and our plan for the next month. It was that kind of intensity. And that deal review was pretty amazing. I remember, you know, I get pretty whiny sometimes about the deal. It'd be like, why the heck did you do this discount and that kind of stuff? And we would kind of mix it up just a little bit about how we were discounting and what kind of terms we were giving. But it's actually very much of, you know, we'll talk about kind of how we built a brand and stuff from Marketo, but it's in some ways how it got started, which is we were an easy company to do business with. I would whine a lot. I remember, you know, I would talk about going into a Porsche dealership and fall in love with the Porsche Turbo, and it was $180,000. And I say to the Porsche dealer, you know, I only have 90. Can I have it? He'd be like, well, I can sell you a Bear Down Cayman or something for that. I'm like, no, I want the Turbo for 90K. I would just kind of bust your chops a little bit because we were doing deals where it seemed like we were giving away really valuable software for too cheap. But all of that was a method of madness. You know, the fact that you and I were looking at it, we were paying attention to it, we were eyes wide open. We knew exactly what we were doing, and it was a calculated gamble, and it's one that it's paid off brilliantly.
I agree. I remember those Porsche conversations very clearly and that analogy. I also remember at that time, and I think it served us well, is I always had this mindset that I would happily take 90 cents today rather than a dollar tomorrow. And I think what was really incredible was I remember as we would hire new people into the organization, they would feel that incredible momentum of like we did 16 last month, now we're going to do 17, and then we'd actually go hit it. And by hook or by crook, we'd find a way, and they would come and they would get caught up in that excitement. And I thought that was a really great way to build, like you said, the momentum inside the organization. In fact, I recall one story. We had an early sales leader named Patrick Donnelly, very important to the history of Marketo sales. And I remember when he would hire a new sales rep, this is in our early days when we sold primarily to small and medium companies, he'd walk them down to where our wall of deals were, because we'd write our deals up every month, and he'd say, do you know any of these company names? And people would look at it and shake their head and say, no, I've never heard of those companies. He'd be like, exactly. That's who we sell to. Now, for early days, that worked really well. But I do remember us having that vision on, let's just go consume the market.
It was just, you know, a machine. And it was really quite incredible. And indeed, you know, we did so many tales that we could just pull out of your few comments there. The intensity that the sales organization had and the environment, you know, we should talk some about that. You and Patrick is a wonderful story, just a leadership story. You know, from early days and for many years, you know, you're number two, and the way you made him better and the way he made you better, and that the two of you did things that any two sales leaders like that working together could never do. But together is an amazing lesson about leadership development and team spirit and teamwork. So just amazing lessons to pull apart here.
Well, team building is going to be one of our topics here. But before we let go of just building early momentum, I'd love to ask, because as you know, Phil, this podcast gets a lot of go-to-market leaders, also a lot of CEOs and founders to watch. I'm curious your perspective on a topic that's a tightrope or a tough dance to do, which is a CEO. When you hire a new operator, your head of marketing, your head of finance, your head of product, your head of sales, how do you relinquish and let them come in and be able to apply, you know, what people would probably call their playbook or their motion to the organization, but also maintain some type of control?
Well, that's a great question, because I'm a consummate operator. I love every function of the business and could dive in and do them. So the ability to, you know, kind of want to be in everybody's world and mix it up is a tendency for mine. But what I realize is that it's all about communication and trust for me. And it's something that you and I had magically from the beginning. It's something that I remember when Fred Ball started as our first and really only CFO for the run at Marketo, the kind of instant communication and trust that he was able to build through some events that happened and some very dark days that happened at the Marketo and with the hosting the system. And the point of that is that by being able to look each other in the eye and realized that you and I, just to take you for a minute, were able to communicate, that you could understand what I was saying, that I could understand that what you were saying, that we were speaking the same language. And even though we didn't agree about everything, we knew how to work through issues. And once you have that kind of communication foundation, then it starts to become easy to devolve trust and to delegate and to relinquish control, because you know that you understand what the other person's doing. You know where they're coming from. You're able to confirm that you've gotten, that I've gotten my own ideas across to you. And once I know that you've heard my ideas as a leader, then it's time to let you do with them what you're going to do. And that ability, I've had people where I just could never get that connection. And without that connection, then it's always, I got to hold it tight. I got to hold it tight. I got to hold it tight. But every one of the spots you talk about ultimately is after years of assembling this thing, that's like assembling an orchestra or a band or whatever it is, as you put the players together, each person and I got that connection. And then at that point, it's an unstoppable team, because there's a degree of trust, there's a degree of delegation. And then from my world, that doesn't mean you don't get up and walk around and pay attention and ask questions and observe and look, but that ability to communicate trust and incrementally release is essential to scalability. It's, you just can't build a business without it.
Yes, I'd agree. And I'd camp onto that with one of the things that I look for and that I try to advise companies when they're hiring executives is to delineate between an executive and a manager. And one of the things is something you just tapped on there, which is there's going to be disagreements. There's going to be some conflict. And how does somebody work through that? Do they have the ability to disagree and then go commit? And I think that's a concept that executives accept, that when I walk into a room, I wear three stripes on my uniform and someone wears four stripes. And sometimes a decision's made, and sometimes it's a combo of our ideas. Sometimes it's my idea. Sometimes it's their idea. But my job is now to go execute that decision, right? That or depart the company. But hopefully they see and can work through that conflict. So I agree with everything that you said about the trust side there.
And I mean, your point about you're hiring an executive and not a manager, and an executive means somebody who has the ability to make their own decisions, to see the bigger picture, to think strategically, to be able to convert ideas into actions. You know, those are the kind of attributes. And it just shows immediately when you have people that start to have that ability, and in fact will disagree and have their own ideas. The richer problem solving, the more ideas, the better the tournament of ideas. You get better answers that way. So the outcome is always better if you can get a team of people like that actually disagree and know how to disagree and yet get on the same page and execute together. It's magic.
Well, that's a nice way to seg into another topic here, which is, I think there was a concept or a spirit that you brought into the organization that I quickly absorbed. I think most people that worked inside Marketo absorbed, which was, I think you'd had a prior mentor essentially whisper in your ear that people are either rooting for you or against you. And so go find a way to get the wind in your sails and find a way to win in the market. I'd love to have you share a little bit of your thought process there, because I used to hear you would share that often.
I just think it's one of the most critical management ideas that I ever learned. And it is exactly that. People are either rooting for you or they're rooting against you. And what that means is that a company, an individual, a leader, a leadership team, a brand, a company can build a followership of influencers. And, you know, today we've got influencers everywhere, and that means something, but there were plenty of influencers back in the day when we didn't have people with ring lights and stuff being influencers. There are, you know, Gartner Group and Forrester and the people that would kind of make those kinds of decisions, the big systems integrators and others. You know, there's just all sorts of individuals that are making noise about players in the market, you know, and if over a cocktail, you know, two people that have nothing to do with the business say, hey, did you hear about Marketo? I hear they're doing really well. Or somebody that used to work for me went to work for a company where they bought that. And little buzz happens. And those kinds of little buzzes are either people saying positive things or not necessarily so positive things. I heard, and, you know, a little bit of predator talk or something like that can be negative. And the idea is all of those interactions cumulatively across days, weeks, months, years form, you know, what ultimately is the brand of a business and the culture of a company. And it turns out that if a company conducts itself well, approaches its users well, behaves well, communicates well, holds its head high, you know, does things properly and does things well, the world will start to root for you. And all of a sudden, it's not just you, it's a whole bunch of people that have your back that are wishing you well and want you to succeed. Or there's a whole bunch of people that are just, they're just as happy as if you fail. And just think about the people you do business with today, the companies, whether consumer or whether in a B2B kind of environment, you know, you could tick off on one finger, probably the companies that you are, you know, thrilled to do business with and the companies that you have to do business with. And the fact that we were able each step of the way, and then you learned it, and then you put it into action with the sales team, and our sales team earned that kind of trust from customers, and that flywheel was unstoppable. And it is, in fact, I think one of the most important business lessons anybody can learn is that people are either rooting for you or they're rooting against you.
I remember a few things. A few moments ago, you made a comment of being easy to do business with. And I remember entering Marketo. I had nothing to do with this. You and the co-founders and the early team did this, but I walked in and I remember winning deals sometimes by what I called the big four. Is we would walk in and we'd say, number one, we offer a free trial. And as lame as that may sound today, our competitors at the time, a lot of them didn't do that. They were built around a professional services implementation. So that was a differentiator. Number two was our pricing was on the website. Like early innovators, that like today, again, like that's there was like, isn't that just obvious? Well, 15, 17 years ago, that wasn't so obvious. Three was we had a trust page up on our site because why? SaaS wasn't early, but it was still unknown. So people wanted to see what your uptime was. And with us being in the email business, people wanted to see of the emails you sent, what percentage got to inboxes. And then fourth, we had a community. We were a very early investor in building a community, like you said, having people talk around you. And it was ungated, which worked not so great because our competitors could go in there and look and see what our user complained about, but it worked really great. And so I remember winning some early deals. Like I just didn't talk about any functionality there. I didn't talk about any value props. What I talked about was how Marketo was to do business with. And I remember those big four separated us from the other players sometimes at the deal level just to get the win.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that just carried over into many things. I mean, you set a tone with the sales team that with certain exceptions, and we can come back and talk about how we made exceptions, but it was the salespeople were taught and to work to align with customers. You know, that was one of your great lessons and one of the things, you know, as many great salespeople as I've worked with over the years, your ability to teach a salesperson how to align with the customer, that is get on the same page to the same side of the table with the customer and genuinely try to see it as a win-win relationship. And I think you taught that to a generation of salespeople in a brilliant way. That's, again, part of this people liking you or not liking you, being easy to do business with, being very transparent in pricing. We were easy to contract with. We didn't insist upon fixed paper. We had commercial lawyers that could, you know, do an agreement if somebody needed something, and we were prudent. But in every respect, it was an attempt to do the right thing for the customer when, you know, basically every action is an attempt to do the right thing for the customer. That again, that positive feedback loop is unstoppable. And, you know, it was one of the, I think, one things that we did spectacularly well.
I do remember, like, the legal is an interesting one that you just kind of triggered that memory. I remember that we would get together every once in a while and I'd come in and say, Phil, we're getting caught up on this term in our T's and C's. And you'd be like, well, let's just work through to make it easy. What did we agree to that got it done with the last couple of customers that fell into it? And we'd go fix it. And we just move forward just to, in the effort to make it easy to do business with. I think that was important. I also, there was along the same lines as the people reading for you, I also remember another concept that you really instilled into the organization, at least into me, was this high road, low road concept of taking the high road and the low road. And I remember one specific example where, in the sense of getting customers to root for you, we would bend over backwards. We'd work on a weekend. You would dispatch some developers to go solve something if somebody needed it, if that customer was in desperate need. So, i.e., that like we put them in that position. And I also remember you the other side. Like, I remember one customer who had unfortunately, in the early days, deleted their contact database. And this was one thing that we really tried to not let happen easily, like kind of a skull and crossbones up there saying what you're about to do is really badly. And I remember you dispatching me to go meet with the CMO. And I was really nervous about it because I had to go up there and essentially say that, look, like we didn't put you in this situation. So we need you to pay to restore your database. And I went to the meeting and I came back and it was a hard meeting. And I came back and I was like, well, I did it. And you said, great. I said, well, how am I supposed to charge them for this thing? It's not a product. It's a service. And you're like, you're not. All I wanted you to do was go up there and show that, look, we didn't put you in this situation. I need them to take ownership of the scenario that their own individual had unfortunately done. And he said, so like the fact that you just did the call, that's the important thing is I think we just taught that customer how to work with us.
I almost gave the whole company, you might recall, a collective coronary too on, along this theme, you know, with my take the high road, which I've long used the phrase that there's really only one way when I was in the workplace to ruin my day, you know, and it wasn't some competitor making some big move or something like that, although we talked about a few of those, but it's a customer saying you're not holding up your end of the bargain. And when a customer would say something like that to me, it literally feels like they're punching me in the gut. I mean, it's just, it has that physical sensation. And that's what leads in some sense beyond just my own ethical foundation and the people I work with, of taking the high road and trying to do right by the customer, trying to do the right thing. And your story was great. But there was a customer I remember up in Montreal. I'm not going to remember their name, but we could not make them happy no matter what. And they wanted to complain. And I had all my senior team in a conference room. You were there. And I got on the phone with this customer and I said, we don't want your business anymore. We're going to give you your money back. You know, we'll give you data. And we'll give you a month to get off the thing, but you're fired. We don't want your business. We can't work with you and you're not holding up your end of the bargain. And this customer could hardly believe their ears because they were, you know, it was a beat 'em up session where they were going to make new demands from me. And of course, the company had never heard me be nasty to a customer or mean to a customer. I would always turn the other cheek and try to do the right thing. It was time not to. And the fact also that I was able to demonstrate to the company when it was time to hold up for ourselves, when we were going to stand up for ourselves, when we were going to say no, when we weren't going to turn the other cheek one more time, after everybody sort of like got over their apoplexy about what I had just done, realized that it's a two-way street and that by holding your customer to those kinds of standards in addition to yourself is how you really create a win-win for everyone.
I recall that. All right, so we're talking about momentum. We're talking about, you know, the wind in your sails, but again, the trip down memory lane here. Let's remember that this is 2008. And anybody that recollects from then, there was a pretty sizable event near the end of the year. And that was the market meltdown that started happening at the end of September of that year, right as Marketo, as we know it today, had been in market for 6 months and our momentum was up and to the right. At that moment, it was a real, real sobering time for us because I think we finished out September pretty successfully, went into October and did well, but we suddenly didn't grow at the same rate that we had been. And then November is where it really hit. And we went in there and I think we were supposed to like sell like 24 new customers and we sold an army of two. And so Phil, take us back there because I remember right coming out of that month, Dreamforce, Salesforce's user conference was going on in late that year in December. And we had most of the team up there and we had this conundrum that we had to think about then.
Oh, it was bleak. The financial crisis had set in full force that November and the bottom was falling out of tech. And we were selling mostly to other young tech companies at that point at Marketo. So, you know, the bottom was falling out on us and was falling out of our buyers at the very same moment, just a colossal way. And, you know, you might recall that Sequoia Ventures in that time put out this famous newsletter to their portfolio companies and to Silicon Valley as a whole with an RIA grave, a tombstone with RIP on it. Rest in peace, meaning, you know, the end of the good days in Silicon Valley, and essentially a directive to their portfolio companies to batten down the hatches, to stop spending, to preserve cash, to stop growth, to lay people off, to go into a maximum defensive posture because you just didn't know how the world was going to go. And you and I and the management team, we talked about it. We talked about our two deals. We talked about going into Dreamforce. We were going to see what the vibe was there in early December. And it was time, and we had raised a big, cool $1.5 million Series A at that point. So we didn't have a lot of cash running around ourselves at Marketo at that point and probably had $700,000 of cash in the bank or something like that. So it was a tough decision. And yet, you know, we went to Dreamforce and there seemed to be interest and people were kind of buying here and there. And so I made a decision with the counsel of the team a few days after this bleak RIP thing came out that we weren't going to do that, that we were going to just keep going. We were going to keep the fires burning. We were going to keep hiring. We were going to keep selling. We were going to keep moving. And that we were going to take the risk that what we were selling was so good and so important and so powerful to help other people get their businesses back on track because we were helping people build better, more efficient revenue machines, that we just kept the course. And it was just magical. And we just left those dark days in the rearview mirror. And it was hardest decision probably of my career, or certainly one of the hardest decisions of my career. Looking you in the eyes, looking the team in the eyes, and doing this together is the only way we made it work.
I remember the meeting up at Dreamforce at Moscone. Yeah. We sat there and talked about it, and we decided, you know, are we going to be austere? Are we going to put the pedal down? And we did come together, and driven by you, decided to push forward. And I remember we came back and had a really strong December. So we thought, well, is that because software buyers are trained to buy at the end of the year? Like, was that just an anomaly? And then we went to January. I think we really realized that one of the big value props of Marketo was it wasn't about saving money. It was about driving growth. And that was very appealing at that moment. And so appealing that right around that same time, 2 or 3 months after this existential decision, we outstripped our ability to be able to serve our customers. We were selling so many of them that the process to onboard them started getting wobbly. And I remember you talking about this. Like, I'd love to have you share some of your thoughts there, because I know that you talked with some other CEOs at that time of how do I solve for this?
Oh, it was, yeah. Well, just, I already said this thing about, you know, the only way to make me miserable is to not hold up my end of the bargain with a customer. And it feels like I've been gut punched. And yet, well, that was a period of just extraordinary growth, faster than we could hire and train talent. Man, we were succeeded at hiring, but there's this kind of rule that pervades high growth software companies, which is that companies can actually grow faster than people can grow skills. And so that becomes often the limiting factor. We had a model where we would do this high performance sales cycle and then work to bring customers live in a very rapid go live process that we would do. At the time, we didn't charge for it. It was just a part of a free service. And we would apply, you know, talented people to help the customer get going. And we just didn't have enough people to do the work. And we had customers that had bought the product and were ready to go. And we, you know, were ready to go with them. And we were just dropping balls right and left. And I was just trying to figure out what to do because customers were telling me I was letting them down. And yet, on the other hand, I had never in my years as an entrepreneur slowed down in a business when things were working. That's just like anathema, right? If you're trying to build a growth business, decides to like slow down. No. And so I couldn't hardly figure out how I was going to do that. But I basically had kind of worked myself up to saying, hey, Bill, we got to slow down a little bit. But I had a lunch with a person that was at the time and was a great mentor to me, Quinto, founder of Zora. And he and I went to lunch in Redwood Shores there. Teen had been a longtime key guy at Salesforce working for Benioff. And so knew kind of their growth story and the culture in that company. And he said to me something just really simply said, Phil, you are just out of your mind. If you slow down on growth, your customers will forgive you. Do your very best. But whatever you do, don't back off on go-to-market because you'll never get it back if you ever take your foot off the gas. And he just looked at me in the eye and was like, had this way to like penetrate and said, do not do it. And I came back with conviction, you know? And it was like a lunch that I probably paid for, and I paid for it 1,000 times over. It was what it was worth. And it was like, we're just going to keep going. And we muddled through. It was all hands on deck. We had people from other departments. I was helping onboard customers, you know, engineers were, and we got to the other side and it was all fine. But I'll tell you, you know, if there's not a moment like that where somebody, you listen to advice and it's just magic. Thanks, team.
Yeah, thanks, team. That was great advice because we did keep charging. And you're right. Like, it's hands on deck. We went to partners, we went to one-to-many training, we used every variety that we could to get those customers, and that shaped how we thought about customer success. So I think we got a lot better at it around that time.
And it created a partner strategy, in fact, that I think was second to none in terms of, you know, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about that today, but the way we build a network of partners, probably right from that moment, was something that startups are still trying to figure out how to do today.
Yeah, I have that on my list here. Before we get to that, though, let's stay in a certain realm here. You just mentioned TN had been at Salesforce. Salesforce was a great model that had started 7 or 8 years ahead of us. Always an interesting relationship. Salesforce was to a seller of what Marketo became to the marketer. And our product had a very impressive, very tight CRM to Marketo integration that was renowned at that point. So a very important partner. Love to have you take us back to some of your thoughts around building of Marketo and the relationship with Salesforce.
Well, it was quite a relationship. The Salesforce, of course, was, I mean, this is what, 2008. So they were some substantial size, you know, at that point. They weren't anything like today. I mean, but they were a multi-hundred-million-dollar business and had already grown up with a reputation of being a juggernaut, you know, an unstoppable company, a growth engine, and a very challenging company in some ways to do business with. And, you know, Benioff was out of the Oracle culture of, you know, it's not enough for us to win, everybody else must lose. from Ellison's day, and very much that kind of culture that was not easy to be friends with, did not partner well, did not try to see eye to eye with other companies. And yet, because every one of our customers was a Salesforce customer, because one of the critical features that was potentially the breakthrough feature technically for Marketo that let us win the marketing in MarTech war was a very tight technical API integration with a Salesforce's API. We had cast the die that our company was going to grow up in the shadow of Salesforce. And, you know, we're going to be the, ultimately became the biggest sponsor of Dreamforce, multi-million dollar checks in the center of the Dreamforce stage and all that kind of stuff. So it became a very big part for us, but it was constantly fraught. Salesforce was always pushing, always wanting more, always trying to charge more and more to be represented on AppExchange, always trying to charge fees to use their APIs, you know, and it went on. So it was a constant attempt to break down partners. And maybe I'm too prideful. Maybe I just realized that if you set yourself up to be number two, you would always be in the shadow. But I was simply never going to give in the same way that lots of companies would. And I was going to, you know, was going to fight back when it was time to fight back. And I made Mark plenty mad at us many a time, his team and everything else. But by holding our head high and by holding our own, we also were able to chart our own course, build our own customers, build our own brand, build the marketing nation, as it turned out. And in fact, have the strength to survive when things really got tough in that relationship in later years. But it's fascinating to figure out how to build in that environment. And then when the days came to, you know, wean ourselves of Salesforce and everything else, one of the hardest management challenges ever to, when you build a monoculture, you know, and every one of your customers is also in their ecosystem, you can get soft in some ways. So it made us soft and it made us very hard all at the same time.
If you went back in time, you know, you brought up a bunch of things, that becoming one of the biggest sponsors of Dreamforce, becoming a huge ISV of theirs, big API consumer of theirs, which they gave away initially for free and then later monetized. If you could go back and think through any of those decisions, are there any that you would change?
Not a one, I don't think.
The day that we got shut down, or the couple, that 72 hours that Marketo and Salesforce didn't talk and our products didn't communicate, that wouldn't?
Well, you know, that was after some, you know, more interesting doings, right? The day that they shut us down was after they bought ExactTarget, I assume you're talking about, right? So it was there. No, that was definitely an existential moment. You know, we took Marketo public in May of 2013. And 3 weeks later, 3.5 weeks later, we learned that Salesforce had bought ExactTarget. We knew ExactTarget very well. We'd been a pretty big partnership with them some years before at Marketo, and ExactTarget themselves had bought a company called Pardot that was one of our smaller competitors in the SMB space. And so all of a sudden, Salesforce, our friend, had become Salesforce, our arch enemy and competitor. And it wasn't necessarily that fun 3 weeks after you take your company public and, you know, you're still in lockup and all those things and the investors want to know what's going on and the sky is falling. And I, you know, ended up doing some press, and Wall Street Journal or whoever wanted to talk to me in the business press. And I was pretty lippy, I would say, which was that we were going to survive, that, you know, it was that we would be fine, that we weren't going to be affected by it, that it wasn't going to affect us and stuff. And it really pissed Mark off that I was not sort of admiring the acquisition and showing the right degree of fear and the right degree of obeisance to what they had done. And he said, turn off the API, shut them down. And they shut us down. And all of a sudden, Marketo wouldn't talk to Salesforce, and Salesforce wouldn't talk to Marketo, and our customers' accounts for Marketo would still send email and stuff, but they couldn't get to the CRM data that was in Salesforce. And that was the end of the world, right? If he did that, and we'd have to go to court, and I was spinning the lawyers up to get to court and everything else. But we went to the court of customer opinion, and that's what worked, because the point was, hey, Mark, you might not like what I did, but those APIs that your customers have from you, they're paying you for those APIs. They're part of your product. And your API terms of use doesn't say you can't talk to Marketo with them. And what we did is we went to our customers and we said to our customers, you have a part in this. You need to go to Salesforce and tell them to turn those APIs back on because you're paying them for those APIs. And the customers were like, well, you're right. We are going to go back. And so we had a bunch of customers. And at this point, these are companies like General Electric and Cisco, not names we had never heard of, that are going to Salesforce and say, turn it back on. And it lasted 3 days, and Salesforce completely caved and realized that we were right and that you cannot take something like this out on the backs of customers. So we could have our fight. We could be arch competitors. We could not get along if it had to be that, but that we couldn't put the customers in the middle. And that, you know, 3 days, and from then on, customers never again experienced anything from what was quite a contentious relationship then on.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of like fascinating story of history, because I don't know how many people have ever heard that and knew that that happened. I certainly remember some of those days. I remember on the rise of Marketo really trying to do something similar that Salesforce had done. Salesforce had obviously come out and really, really like disenfranchised Siebel. And they were obviously arch competitors, but they did it by trying to stand out, by to be different. And I liked the different part. And I always felt that we were trying to do something similar at Marketo. I didn't think we were trying to poke them in the eye, but I think unfortunately we did. Like you said about the user conference stuff, they would host their Dreamforce thing and we would do the takeover of the Modern Museum of Art next door. And I think they would see that as like we were stealing their attendees and stuff like that. But I look back and say like, wow, it's kind of brilliant marketing. And in fact, I think some of the people on our marketing team kind of created a model that then got copied for many years to come and is still played out by going over and trying to take over and own your partner's user conference.
It's not a zero-sum game. You know, it's like if you see it as a zero-sum game, then if you quote unquote do something of your own, the other party can see it as taken away. But if you see it as we're just making a bigger party, a bigger event, making customers even more successful because they see more options and they, you know, enjoy the event more. And so they're happier too. You know, so I always saw it as how do you stand out? How do we build our own brand in the context of a very strong brand, which is hard enough in and of itself, but it's never about trying to take anything away from anyone. Because like I said, it's not zero sum.
Now, remind me of the story. You had a lot of meetings across the time frame with Salesforce, but I think there was one really key one that you went up there and you met with George Hu. Mind sharing that one?
Oh, it's just a funny little lesson. It was an important meeting. You know, it was before things got really wacky between the two companies, but we were trying to figure out how to do more. We wanted to spend more. We wanted to be involved more. We wanted a deeper relationship because, as I said, you know, all of our customers were their customers and vice versa. And we were growing to multi-hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue in their space. And we were there for somebody to take seriously. So I went up, had some chit-chat with Mark and their executive floor in their old building on One Market Street. But I had a meeting with George primarily. And I just had a little piece of business I wanted to get taken care of along the way on the side because I was really bummed because we were at that point, although we were very much frenemies, we were kind of, you know, also a little bit enemies with HubSpot, who was growing up. They were about the same size. They were founded about the same size, selling in some cases to the same customers. And all of a sudden, Salesforce was doing this set of ads with HubSpot where they were running ads together. And it was just like stuck under my skin. And I would go to marketing and say, like, why can't we have this and everything else? And was bouncing off the walls. And I pulled George aside and I said, George, you know, what's going on? We do everything. Like, why are you doing this with HubSpot and you won't do it with us? And he looked me right back in the eye and he said, Phil, because Brian Halligan called us and asked. And it was just like the most simple thing where I realized that I was bouncing off the walls and I was upset and I was bouncing off our marketing people hadn't done the right thing. And Brian picked up the phone and called Mark and said, let's do some ads together. Let's do a marketing campaign together. And Mark said, sure. And George was like, if you had just made that call instead of Brian, we'd have said yes to you as well. And I think it's probably true. And it was just like this incredible lesson of simplicity, person-to-person communication. I had worked this all up into a whole storyline. If I just picked up the phone, life would have been maybe different. And it just was, it's just one of those little lessons, but you know, somehow just its whole context was like, stay with me to last day I'd do anything in business.
Great transition into the topic of competition. So to tee this up, Phil, I started my career at Oracle, which had a very aggressive competitive stance of cut off the oxygen type of approach. And when I came into Marketo, I think you had a different point of view on that, where your mindset was a little closer to, let's talk to our customers about how we solve their problems. And let's not badmouth the other players out there. Let's just go and show how we can uniquely bang our fist on the table and tell you that, like, we create value by solving this problem for you and we can quantify it over here. That competitive mindset, please share more on that.
I am just an extraordinarily competitive person in life and business. So I approach everything with just that kind of ferocious competitive spirit. But I have in many cases, very different kind of point of view about it. Number one, you know, you play the long game, not the short game. You know, this is about how you compete and win over a matter of years, not over a matter of months and things. So many, many things to talk about there. But one of the primary things about competition is that vendors all want to chew each other up. You know, in a competitive environment, the standard thing in tech is, you know, you talk about why your product's good and then you talk about why your competitor's product is less good and you have kill sheets to, you know, well, they don't do this and they don't do that and we're better at this and they don't do that and they lost this customer and they churned this, whatever. And so you end up in this thing that just sounds ridiculous to customers because it's like two little kids in a, you know, on a tetherball court or something like that, having a fight rather than talking about the customer. So one of the, you know, rules that was always the rule that like you got right behind and the team did was that when we were going to talk to customers, we were going to talk about us. We were going to talk about them. What are your problems? And it was one of the things in our sales team that if the customer said, what would Eloqua do here? Why would Eloqua be better? Tell me about what Eloqua, the answer from our sales rep would be, I don't know, ask them. Let me tell you about how we solve your problem. And let me tell you about a customer like you that's solving your problem. And by making that just a touchstone in the sales organization and the go-to-market organization was one of a many, many such plays that would lead us to always be telling our story. It is so easy to get in your competitors' heads because as soon as you start to say something about a competitor, then they need to respond. And if a competitor starts to take that bait, it's all over with. And I remember, it's a great story. I probably told it on a podcast not too long ago, but I remember that our arch competitor was Eloqua. They had, you know, many year head start. They were a bigger business. They were selling to bigger companies. And it was a brutal, tough competition that we were having with them. But we were winning, we were taking share, and they were kind of freaking out. And so they started on a massive project called Eloqua Ken that they were going to rebuild their product and build a new user interface that was going to make their product easier to use and more marketable like. And I just remember the day that we had been in, and I was into Gartner Group, and we were presenting our last thing, and we were with the top analyst that was covering MarTech for Gartner, and we told our whole story. And she said, you know, Phil, your competitor Eloqua was in here yesterday and they showed us their new product. And it's the most amazing thing. They kept talking about their product was the Marketo killer. And every third word out of them was how they were going to kill Marketo with their product and how this feature was going to kill Marketo and that feature was going to kill Marketo. And you came in today and you gave us the exact same presentation about your product. She said, you never mentioned Eloqua. You only mentioned your customers. You only mentioned your product and your solution. And you only told us how you were making customers successful. And it was so amazing. What we had done is we had so gotten into their head that they had torqued their product release into being the Marketo killer. They were no longer listening to customers and building features their customers were asking for. They were listening to Marketo and building features to respond to us. And I could have built, you know, crazy numbnut, stupid features, and they would have gone running off into building features to chase us. And at that point, I knew we had won because they were following us. They were responding to us. They were going into Gartner Group and saying, we are responding to a Marketo. And I was like, this doesn't get any better when your competitor basically hands it right to you like that. And that ability to always talk about yourself, always talk about your customers, always talk about what you're doing well, and let your competitors tell their story, it's a winning strategy every time.
All right, everyone. That brings us to the conclusion of part one of our podcast with Phil Fernandez. We covered a lot of topics in it, so much so that we decided to break this into two parts. So stay tuned for part two coming to you shortly.